session number 30,001, Mr. Peter Hurst, Reel 10. Now, we're talking about various flights you got while you were with the first operation training unit, well, sixth operation training unit at Sutton Bridge, the first of the two you were with. Now, you also had some flights in a ferry battle. Now, I'm quite interested in the ferry battle because there's not many people that have thrown and left now. Well, what could you describe what it was like to fly? Because it's got a bad reputation, I think.
Yes, well, I never flew it operationally, of course, but to fly as a hack aircraft, it was quite good because it had a long fuselage, and you could get four or five chaps in the fuselage if you wanted to go off somewhere. And I used to fly it around occasionally, and I didn't do a hell of a lot of flying. Although I did give some dual instruction on the battle to the American here. But anyway, I'm just jumping ahead a bit. Let's go back to.
And what did you think of its flying characteristics? I mean, was it agile or powerful? Or,
No. It had the same engine as the Hurricane. Excuse me, I'm going to cough. and there was the Merlin. But of course, the airframe was about twice the size and almost twice the weight of the Hurricane. Therefore, the performance was not very impressive, but still, it was a useful aircraft as a hack aircraft. The few battles that were left probably were survivors from France, and that's how we got them. But I did several flights on the battle. I've got them logged here in my logbook.
Now, that includes one rather naughty flight, if it
is. Yes, the one I took a chap by the name, he was a flight lieutenant then, he finished up as a group captain, I think, but his name was Powell Shedden. And he was going up, he wanted to go to Swinderby because he was getting married up there. And he asked me if I would take him up. So I said yes. So it was only half an hour's flight from Sutton Bridge to Swinderby. And I took him there and came back afterwards. And the next thing I knew, I was called before the commanding officer at Sutton Bridge. And he told me that the contractors up there who were still working complained that about this ferry battle landing there before the place was open. And I got a bit of a telling off, but it was all right. That was it.
Did you tell him why you'd done it?
Oh, yes. I told him why I'd taken this chap up, dropped him off, and he was going up to get married. And he was a jolly good chap, old Peter Powell Shetton.
Would that sort of thing be in your logbook? Did you record every flight? Do you see what I mean?
Every flight.
Even if it was utterly unofficial?
Oh, yes.
So just hacking to...
Yeah. Yeah, every flight. You see, there it is. Battle. It was the 25th of June, 1940. And I'd done three flights before. And flight before I took Peter Powell Shedden up was the same day, 25th, and I flew the battle for the first time. And I got the experience on type. I had two passengers, God knows who they were. Then the next flight was taking Peter Powell to Swinderby.
Now, one thing you started doing was formation flying, blind flying in clouds. I mean, you hadn't done night flying yet, particularly, had you?
I'd done some practice night flying, but not operational night flying.
But you were doing blind flying in clouds with hoods and things. Can you tell me about that a bit?
When we were climbing up, if you might had a day when the cloud base was quite low, sometimes 1,500 feet, say. And you could go up and you climb through the cloud and come out on top. If it was not too thick, but sometimes you go on and on and on, you never come out. So just flying on instruments all the time. And in the earlier days of my flying training, that was part of the training to do instrument flying.
So did they maintain their formation well with these new... Well, they weren't new, were they? This is operational flying training, but I mean...
Yes.
Were they...
Yes, they weren't bad. First of all, you had to give them a good briefing before you went off and tell them what you were going to do and what you expected them to do. And then we had RT communication between aircraft, so you could tell them a little bit over that. But what we used to do was, when we landed back, then we had to have a debriefing and cover the items which... I felt was necessary that they should know about, and that was it.
What about the flying with a hood? I presume that was in the Magister, would it be, or the,
with the hood?
With the hood over the pupil, so that they had to use their instructions.
Yes, on the Magister that used to take the place, and in the Harvard, I just can't remember now what they had in the Harvard and. Used to sit in the back seat. See, so the chap in the front seat could see he was the safety pilot.
To make sure they didn't do things stupid. How did they manage? I mean, was it difficult?
Well, we used to do quite a lot of practice instrument flying. And once we got used to it, it was all right. I mean, then, of course, whenever you went into cloud, you were immediately on to instruments and there was no problem. Provided you'd carried out sufficient training.
Now, you weren't there long, were you? You were new flying training, you know.
I was only there for about 3 weeks. And then I went, the new OT was set up at Howden, near Chester. And they had Spitfires there. Number 7 OTU. And they had Spitfires there.
Now, what was the background setting of this OT? I mean, why do you have such a short posting to the number 6?
Because number 7 was a new one. And they took some of the instructors from number 6 and some of the instructors from number 5, which was down near Gloucester somewhere. What was the name of it?
It doesn't matter too much.
Aston Down.
So
they took some of the instructors to form the nucleus of the instructors of this new OTU at Harden. And the reason for the new OTU is because Aston Down and Sutton Bridge both had hurricanes, and the Spitfires were coming in fairly fast. And they hadn't got a Spitfire OTU, and so this was the first Spitfire OTU.
Now, what was the setup at Howden? I mean, it wasn't really an airfield. It wasn't particularly ready for you, was it?
No, it wasn't. Over the other side of there, we had a couple of semi-detached houses as the station headquarters, where the group captain had his office in one of these semi-detached houses. And we had tents as our flight officers, also we slept in tents, and our officers' mess was a marquee, not very big, but big enough, and that was how Harden started.
Was it all right in town? Oh, it was July when you went.
Yes,
there,
you see, it was.
It couldn't have been too bad.
Oh, yes. No, it was okay. The summer months. And then eventually we took over Harden Castle, which was the Gladstones' home. And we used that as an officer's mess, and that was about a couple of miles away.
What was it like in Howden? I know that's a bit later, but we'll follow it through now. What was it like in Howden Castle? I mean, that's quite a grand place.
Oh, it was very nice, yes. And most of the furnishings were left there. and it was very good.
Were the family there?
When I was the first one to go there, and the family were there then, and there was the chap, he was, and his sister, neither of them were married, and they were, I was thinking they were mid-50s, something like that, and he was the grandson of the original Gladstone.
The Prime Minister of Gladstone?
Yeah.
Now, so you were comfortable there. Now, what about the Spitfire? This is your first time in the Spitfire. It seems to be 6th of July, 1940. You had a familiarisation flight just before that. Well, no, that was your familiarisation flight. Now, what were your first impressions of the Spitfire? What was it like to fly? What were the advantages and disadvantages of it as an aeroplane?
It was nicer in the air than the Hurricane.
In what way?
In the general handling characteristics, the rolling, it had a better rate of roll. And of course, it was a little bit faster than the Hurricane. Not a huge amount, but it was generally, I think, a smoother aircraft to fly. Is working next door.
Was it a lot faster? I mean,
no, not a lot. Probably about 10 or 20 miles an hour, something like that. No, it wasn't a huge difference. But it was a smoother aircraft to fly.
So you did prefer it?
Yes.
Was it? Because a lot of people seem to think it's much better than the Spitfire. Did you find that, or was it more you just preferred it?
No, I generally preferred the Spitfire, then having got used to it. I mean, you know, my first few flights where I was, well, I did experience on type on July the 6th. And then, 2 days later, I was teaching the pupils now what we call number one and five attacks. We gave them numbers.
Now, so, there's some interesting features about the Spitfire that I think you're probably the ideal person to talk about. One is it's difficult to take off and land in it. Can you just talk to me? It's slightly different, isn't it?
Yes, I'll tell you. The nose is longer than the Hurricane, and it's up at a greater angle in front of you. So you can't, when you're taxiing on the ground, you can't see straight ahead, so you have to zigzag, and you look out each side so that you can see what's ahead. And that always had to be right through the war. You always had that long nose in front of you.
And what about the takeoff and landing? The landing. How would you get over that?
On the landing, you didn't do a straight-in approach. You did a turned approach, gradually turning until you had selected your landing run. We didn't have runways in those days, and you selected the particular bit of grass or the airfield that you wanted to land on. Then you straighten up, and you've seen it was all clear in your final turn. Straighten up and put it down.
So once you got used to it, it wasn't that much of a problem.
Oh no.
Now what about inside? Firstly, it had wind-up landing wheels, didn't it? Can you just explain that a bit?
Yes.
Undercarriage.
Yes, the undercarriage. Well, you had a selector up or down, and then you had a pump. So if you were taking off, as soon as you got airborne, or safely airborne, you would then select up for the wheels, and then you would have to, it was a long pump on the starboard side, the right-hand side, and you had to pump this pump. Now, to do that, you had to take your hand off the throttles, hold the control column, which was a spade grip, with the left hand, while you were pumping it with the right hand. Because some of the chaps in the early days, you know, we used to tell them, but they used to forget. They sometimes used to forget to tighten up their throttle quadrant nut. So, with the vibration, the throttle was gradually sliding back, and they were losing power. So then they had to change back and remember what has happened, tighten up the throttle nut, so then push the throttle into full throttle position again and do start again. So then the other thing that they used to do with this pump, an automatic thing, they just doing this. So the aircraft was...
So they moved their left arm, left hand holding the joystick in time.
Yes, yes.
Which would make the aircraft go up and down.
That's right. Yeah. Okay. So then we used to tell them, now, when you're using the pump to get the undercarriage up, put your left elbow into your ribs, and then you can hold the control column steady. And they got over it in the end.
Any other? I mean, the other thing is that a lot of bruised fists. And I mean, was it the clearance for your hand? There's a reference in your book to that they'd have they bruise themselves.
Oh yes. Well, you see, this pump was very close to the side of the fuselage, and most chaps, when they, of course, used to hold the pump like this, you see, and they were launching their hands on the. You can tell there was precious little space between the pump handle and the metal fuselage, which was quite sharp. So we used to say, don't hold the pump with like that, put your hand on top. So, and that was another thing that you get used to.
Was a room for catastrophic error, you know, putting it down or up, or, you know, landing it within the wrong place? I mean, could it cause trouble if you pressed the wrong button at the wrong time?
Well, with the earlier ones, of course, you had to pump the undercarriage down as well as pumping it to bring it up. So you then select down on your lever, it's either up or down, select down, and then you had to pump them down until it became rigid, and the pump, you couldn't move it anymore, and then you knew. And you had some lights, so the red lights went to green. When the lights were green, the pump was solid, you knew the undercarriage was...
Oh, it sounds a bit dodgy. Did you feel it was...
No, we got used to it.
Now, what about the controls, generally? Were they pretty well the same, and instruments?
The instruments were exactly the same as the Hurricane. And the controls are slightly more sensitive, certainly on the ailerons. It was more sensitive than the Hurricane.
Why was that, do you think? I
think it was because of the different design of the wing.
Anything else about it that comes to mind?
Not particularly, no. It was a nice aeroplane to fly. And, of course, it wasn't too long after my early days that they brought out the Spitfire with the... automatic undercarriage.
So this system is the Spitfire 1,
yeah.
Mark 1. So how did the pupils take the Spitfire? Was it an aeroplane that, you know, that they could get used to reasonably quickly? Or
yes. Well, we used to give them every one of them had a dual trip in a Miles Master. And I've got in here lots of quite a few trips where I gave chaps, and we told them, what we tried to show them was the type of approach that they had to make in the Spitfire. Now, the one I was just telling you about, where you had a gradual turn in before landing, rather than you couldn't come straight in because you couldn't see sufficient. But I've got quite a few trips here, you see, master, where I was... also gave them formation practice in the master, and then so that they knew what was required once they got into a Spitfire.
Now, one thing I'm interested in the book is it talks about the tactics used in the Battle of France being dispensed with, and it sounds a bit early to me because I don't see how you would know to dispense with them as you have.
Well, I'll tell you, in France. We were doing these standing patrols all day long, three aircraft up and down the borders, the German-French borders. And we used to fly at about 25,000 feet. And we used to go up and down these... this country, it wasn't necessary to do that because you had all the radar, and they were able to give you early warning about any advancing aircraft. Whereas in the old days in France, we were our own warning system. We had to keep our eyes skinned and watch out for any aircraft which we couldn't identify, or we could identify as being German.
Did you change the actual tactics in combat? You know, because I was just a bit dubious as to how you'd know in July, you know, the Battle of the lessons would feed through to you.
Well, the type of attacks were the same as we would. We had what we called number one attack and number three attack.
Because it's in the book. It says those three strategies were rejected. Number one, fight attack. Number two, fight attack. Number three, fight attack. So they were rejected. And it just seemed a bit early for me that they were rejected. I couldn't quite understand.
Well, they weren't completely rejected. In fact, I think if I look here, we can see. You see, I've got here, we were teaching them what we call number one and five attacks. Numbers one and five attacks, I was teaching them. I can't remember what the five attack was now, but...
So I think that it looked to me at the time when I read it that it was wrong in the book, and it looks like it, at this stage it is wrong. Number one, five attack, a section of fighters attacking a lone enemy bomber, attacking line astern, it says, but I'm not sure about that either.
We only seem to do numbers one and five attacks, and I can't remember now exactly. One was coming from the side and into the rear. I can't remember what number.
The sort of classic curve.
Yes, yes. I can't remember what a number five attack was. No.
There also seems to be firing on a fire at a range in the River Dee.
Yes, we had so the chaps could practice firing their guns, so they knew what it felt like to fire the guns before they joined a squadron.
How accurate were they? I mean, what level of skill did they have with their...
Oh, they didn't get very much time for that, because in those days the squadrons, fighter squadrons, were so pressed for pilots, and they wanted them through as quickly as we could produce them. So in those days, I would think the average time of a chap being at Harden was about 3 weeks, which is not a very long time at all.
Did you think they'd had enough training?
Barely enough. They could get into a squadron, but then they had to learn quite a lot more when they joined the squadron.
So they still had a fair way to go. It's all part of a long process.
Yes, yes.
Now, how did you manage training pupils who were, in some cases, older than yourself? Because you were still pretty young.
I'd been in France. I'd had the experience of France, and of course, that was, until the Battle of Britain started, which was around about mid-July. We were the only chaps who had operation experience, despite our age.
So they looked up to you?
Yes.
The bee's knees at the time.
Yeah.
Now, some of the pupils you had are worth talking about, I think, simply because they're very well known.
Yes.
If I name them to you, I'm looking at the book as well, and perhaps see what you thought of them, both as pilots and as individuals, because we're quite interested in the level of their flying skills when you saw them, not what they became. The first one is Paddy Finucane.
Oh, Paddy Finucane, yes. Yes. Well, they were pretty good. Paddy Finucane, if I remember rightly, he was a short service chap like myself, but had been on Lysanders or some other aircraft, but he hadn't been on a fighter squadron. And so he picked it up pretty well. But he was that much further ahead than some of the chaps who came straight out of flying training school.
What was he like as a bloke, Finucane?
Oh, he was a nice chap. Yeah. I'd never had a great deal of time to get to know him all that well.
Just three weeks.
Yeah.
Was he a natural on the Spitfire? In fact, that's a question we'd ask of all of them, really. Or would he make the same mistakes as the other pupils? You know, the up and down on taking off.
Oh, yes. Yes, they all did that, regardless, until we sort of put them straight.
So, no, what about Paddy Barthrop?
Oh, Paddy Barthrop. Yes, he was a mad Irishman, and I've got some photographs of him.
In what way mad?
Well, he was just he'd been on Lysanders in France. So, you see, he hadn't flown fighters. So when he finished he was a pre-war short service, like myself. And when he finished his training, he went on to Lysanders, and of course they were sent to France, and they had heavy losses, and they came back, and they put most of the chaps onto fighters, and he was one of them.
And what was he like as a pilot?
Oh, he was pretty good, yes.
Now, you used to socialise with him, it says here. I mean, did you get to know him better, Barthrop, than most of them?
Yes, I suppose I did, because not only at Harden, but I met him a number of times later. In fact, even after the war, I've known him, and he and I, we still see each other occasionally. We're both about the same age.
Now, what about the other one? It's Johnny Johnson.
Yes.
James Johnson. Johnny Johnson. What was he like?
Oh, he was quite a bit older than us. He was about 5 years older than me.
That's a big gap at that age.
Yes, oh yes. But nevertheless, from the flying point of view, I was more experienced than him at the time. So, and I was an instructor, so he was okay. And then eventually he went on and made a name for himself.